This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Women in the Republican Party, who are they? And what issues do they want to see championed in D.C. and at the local level? Coming up, we'll speak to Connecticut women who are registered Republicans, and we'll hear from a columnist who's critical of the mainstream idea that to be pro-woman, you must identify with liberal politics and the Democratic Party. We want to hear from you. Are you a woman registered in the Republican Party? Have you felt alienated at times from other women because of your party loyalty? Join the conversation. Email Where We Live at WMPR.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. First, we wanted to know how the role of women has changed in the GOP. Joining us now is Catherine Rimpf, Associate Professor of History at the University of Missouri, author of Republican Women, Feminism and Conservatism from Suffrage Through the Rise of the New Right. Catherine, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here.
Now, your book begins about the women's role in the early conservative movement. We're talking in 1920 with the woman's right to vote. Tell us about that time, and how did women get involved in the Republican Party?
Right. Well, when women got the right to vote, there was a big question for suffragists and also for women who hadn't necessarily been active suffragists, but they recognized that they have a new civic role. And the question was, to be involved in politics, should they join political parties or should they continue to work in separate organizations, women's organizations that were mobilized around certain issues like the temperance issue or gaining other kinds of rights for women? Because a lot of women worried that if they joined political parties, they were entering into a really corrupt institution of smoke-filled rooms where back deals were making, and they really believed that their brand of politics was more pure. So a lot of women don't join parties at all, but there were others who thought, you know, if we really want to have a say in the politics of our country, we need to join a political party. And so some do join both Democratic and Republican parties, but it's a struggle to establish a real presence there where they have any influence.
What kind of women got involved?
Well, they would be, in terms of the Republican Party, they would be women who were already fairly active in maybe in the suffrage movement, in local politics, in their own cities. Some women who were wives of Republican politicians. And so one of the forms of activism, if you want to call it that, that you see in the beginning is pretty elite women forming Republican women's clubs. And in some parts of the country, those Republican women's clubs were very involved in trying to organize women to vote for the party. In other parts of the country, they were more like kind of elite social clubs where women got together and did things, you know, that elite women did. They weren't necessarily on the ground trying to organize. So there was a real range.
So there were club women and then party women.
Right. And the party women were the women who wanted to actually enter the party. I mean, parties were a lot stronger than they are now. So the idea of entering a party would mean you would formally join a party. And for the women that I talk about as party women, those are women who are then also taking on leadership roles, being the local precinct woman or being on the Republican National Committee. And the Republican Party in the 1920s does, in response to women's suffrage, doubles the size of the Republican National Committee. It previously had, you know, one man from every state, and the size was doubled so that there would also be one woman from every state. So that's why we still have that system today, a Republican committee man and committee woman. And the Democrats did the same thing because both parties are trying to win over the votes of women. And this is a way that they can show, look, we're the party of women because we have women on our, you know, governing bodies of our parties.
So if we jump forward to the 60s and 70s, that was another major turning point for women, this idea of second wave feminism. Tell us about that time and how the issues may have changed.
Right. Well, when second wave feminism emerged as a grassroots movement, it had took a lot of different forms, a lot of different shapes, and different women organized around different issues. And the women that I think of as sort of the political feminism, that part of the feminist movement, really wanted to see more women in elected office and wanted to use the kind of mainstream political process to achieve goals for women. And initially, political feminism was not associated with one party more than the other. What you saw was in both the Democratic and Republican parties, efforts by women in those parties to see women's issues taken more seriously, to see women playing a greater role at party conventions, and to see more women running for office. One of the big feminist issues of the 70s was the issue of the Equal Rights Amendment, and it was initially an issue that had supporters in both parties and opponents in both parties. And Republican women, Republican feminists, there were a number of prominent Republican women who really identified with the feminist movement, particularly with the issue of ERA and with abortion rights. And they worked within their party to get those issues a hearing in their parties to try to keep support for the ERA in the Republican Party. It had been there since the 1940s. And to get men in the party to take women more seriously.
I'm speaking with Catherine Rimpf. She's Associate Professor of History at University of Missouri, author of the book Republican Women, Feminism and Conservatism from Suffrage to the Rise of the New Right. Catherine, you mentioned about the different roles of women in the party. There are two women that come to mind reading your book. One was Phyllis Schlafly and Mary Louise Smith. And how did they come from two different spectrums?
Right. Well, they're both Midwestern women. They have that in common. They were both, you know, extremely bright women who got involved in party politics, going back to the 1950s. For Mary Louise Smith, who's probably less familiar to your listeners than Phyllis Schlafly, Mary Louise Smith got involved as a grassroots organizer for her party, doing the work that women in both political parties did in the 40s, 50s, 60s, gearing up for election day. They were the ones who went out and encouraged people to vote. They would drive voters to the polls. They would do that kind of grassroots organizing that was so vital to the party. And that's how she got started. She, in the 60s, she ran to be a Republican National Committee woman from Iowa in a fiercely contested race, and she won. And so that got her onto the national stage. And what made her the most prominent was after Watergate and the resignation of Richard Nixon, when the Republican Party was really trying to project a new image to the country that, you know, we're a changed party. We're a party of the future. One of the ways that they tried to do that was by nominating the first woman to chair a Republican or party, National Party Committee. She became the first woman to chair the Republican National Committee and was there during the Ford administration and through the election of 1976. And she was one of these women who strongly identified as a feminist. Phyllis Schlafly was becoming prominent around the same time, beginning in the 60s, really taking off in the 70s, as an organizer of women opposed to the Equal Rights Amendment. So they were both Republican women. They were both known for their grassroots organizing. They were both known for their positions on women's issues, but they were on very opposite sides of a number of issues, ERA being the most prominent.
Now, Catherine, when we talk about Mary Louise Smith being a feminist, what did it mean to be a Republican feminist? What issues were most important at that time?
For her, and again, feminism was a diverse movement at the time. It still is today. For her, it was a notion of equality and individuality, and, you know, the rights of individuals. And she talked a lot about, you know, she and her colleagues, when they made their argument to the Republican Party that it really needed to get out in front on feminist issues, what they argued was that these are inherently Republican issues, that issues of equal opportunity and the rights of the individual are part of the Republican Party ideology going back to its founding. And so that there was nothing in their argument, nothing un-Republican about taking on those those issues. And that was their strategy for getting those issues out in front within the party.
But then when Reagan was nominated, things started to change with this role of the feminists in the Republican Party?
Yes. When, Ronald Reagan did actually run in 1976 as well. He challenged Gerald Ford for the Republican nomination. And that was a moment when you could see the Republican Party splitting between sort of established moderates who had been, largely in charge of the party for a long time, and a kind of a challenge from what we today think of as social conservatives in the party, and the broader platform of Ronald Reagan, who rallied around him in 76. And he's not nominated, but one of the issues that in 76 was the issue of a Republican support for the ERA. And when Reagan was nominated in 1980, that year Republicans took ERA out of its platform. It had been in there since the 1940s. And they also inserted a plank that called for a constitutional amendment to ban abortion. And this was very challenging for women like Mary Louise Smith, who identified very strongly as both Republicans and feminists. And I think this is one of the interesting things in listening to how you're framing the discussion that you're going to have later on in the program. Republican feminists had to decide what they were going to do in 1980, and some prominent Republican women did not support Reagan that fall. Some of them went and worked for the third-party campaign of John Anderson. Some of them eventually wander away from the Republican Party. For Mary Louise Smith, the Republican Party was her home. She had had her entire political career through the Republican Party. That's where all of her contacts were. All of her ability to be influential was within that party. And so she stayed in, and she worked with the Reagan campaign in an organization that was set up to appeal to women voters, to recruit women voters to vote for Reagan in the fall. And some people criticized her for that, and her position was, she was a feminist, but she was also a Republican, and that she really opposed Jimmy Carter on a number of issues, particularly economic issues and defense issues. And so for someone like Mary Louise Smith, it made no sense to leave the Republican Party and vote for a Democrat. That was very far away from her her background, her ideology. But the women's stuff was very hard for her.
So the women that stayed within the Republican Party, people like Phyllis Schlafly, they were the ones that they didn't really align with gender solidarity, but with issues that matter to them individually?
I would think of Schlafly different than that. I think she was a political leader for whom gender was very, very important. She organized women, and she organized them around certain understandings of their position as women, and the argument that feminist issues like the ERA would harm women. That was her perspective. So she very much organized women and organized around gender issues. She just came to a different conclusion.
But she was someone that really focused on the family, and something that we see as the Republican Party changed through the years with more of a leaning towards the Christian right.
Right. She was a Catholic, and she did organize a lot of evangelical women before we really talked about a Christian right. That was a term that emerges a little bit later, but certainly we can see her as a precursor to that kind of organizing.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're looking at the role of women in the Republican Party. Our first guest, Catherine Rimpf, Associate Professor of History at University of Missouri, author of Republican Women, Feminism and Conservatism, From Suffrage to the Rise of the New Right. Catherine, what can we learn from looking back at history and how the parties have changed and how they now may appeal to women so lately we're hearing so often that if to be pro-woman, it is someone who identifies with the liberal party, the Democratic Party, but that's not necessarily true. So what do you see as the trend as we look at the Republican Party today?
Well, I think it's certainly a very interesting time, and I think we see, a lot of women did vote for Donald Trump in this last election, despite, I think, what a lot of commentators assumed, that some of his comments about women and behavior towards women would turn women voters away. It did turn a lot of women voters away, but I think if we look back to women like Mary Louise Smith from the 1980 election, I think there's probably a range of responses that women who voted for Trump had. Some of them really were not bothered at all by his comments about women, and they happily voted for him. Others were really disturbed by his comments, but for them, there was a whole picture of their party and their larger political ideology that was not going to make it possible for them to vote for an alternative candidate. And I think we have to understand women voters as complex political actors, that they have to make complicated choices. And I think we all do that in elections. We make choices about what issues we can compromise on in one particular election. Sometimes we hold our nose and vote. Sometimes we vote enthusiastically, and women are no different than other voters in that regard.
I want to thank you, Catherine Rimpf, again, Associate Professor of History at University of Missouri. We appreciate your perspective.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, we'll meet some Connecticut Republican women who are also involved in the party on the local level. And we want to hear from you. Are you a female Republican? Do you consider yourself a feminist? Join the conversation. Email wherewelive at WMPR.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Opponents of then-presidential candidate Donald Trump thought he was in big trouble with women voters because of his past comments. But we now know the naysayers were wrong. In fact, 42% of women, many who were white, voted for him. So what were the issues that spoke to them? The same issues that spoke to male Trump supporters, including the economy and their views on leadership. We know not everyone that supported now President Trump are registered Republicans, but today we're talking about women in the Republican Party, especially after there has been much attention on how liberal women perceive politics today. Now, joining the discussion right now on the phone is Carol Markowitz. She's a columnist for the New York Post. Carol, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So earlier in the hour, we were talking about the history of feminism and how it had some roots in the Republican Party. These days, when we think about the party, a lot of people view it as anti-women. What's your take on that?
Oh, that's just ridiculous. I think that the idea that a political party in America is anti-woman is absurd. And I think one of the main problems with that is that we've decided to identify being pro-woman as being pro-choice, and those two things don't necessarily align. There are many pro-life women, and it doesn't necessarily tie that a pro-life woman won't be a feminist. There's, the new wave feminists who wanted to march in the Women's March against Trump were conservative women who were pro-life, but had voted against Trump. And, women are complex actors, like as Catherine said. Nobody counts on men to vote as men, and yet women get told they should vote as a woman. And there's something really weird about treating women as if they're some sort of small special interest group when they're over half the country. So, yeah, I definitely don't think the Republican Party or non-liberals are anti-women. I think that's just ridiculous, no.
Well, if we look into your background, you've worked for politicians. You've mm-hmm. been a conservative blogger. Tell us about your relationship to the Republican Party.
So for many years, I always refer to myself as a conservative, but I worked in the party because I worked for people that I felt represented my values. And I think in the last few years, even though I am still a registered Republican, I definitely refer to myself almost exclusively as a conservative, because that's not going to change. What my values are and what I believe isn't going to change, but the party can change around me, and in fact has, with the nomination and election of Donald Trump. I was a never Trump Republican. I couldn't support him for a variety of reasons that didn't have anything to do with the mainstream feminism reasons. It had nothing to do with abortion or any other reasons that women from the left had attacked him. I saw him as not conservative enough, and I thought the party had nominated somebody that wasn't a conservative, so I couldn't support him for that reason. So, yeah, it's a complicated dance when your party sort of changes around you. But I do still feel that generally the Republican Party represents me better than the Democrats do, and I do tend to still vote Republican.
Now, you live and work in New York City?
Right. I grew up in Brooklyn, so being a Republican was always kind of a challenge anyway. But, yeah, there's definitely, you know, it's a harder hoe out here, but there were definitely areas of Brooklyn that Trump had captured, which I think were surprising to some people. But it happened, you know.
Now, you've attended CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, for the past 15 years. The most recent one made a lot of news because of President Trump. What did you see this year? How is CPAC changing?
I definitely saw that there was a shift in the attendees towards Trump from last year, where there was still kind of the hope that Trump was going to be stopped as a nominee among conservatives. And this year there was a real acceptance of Trump and his message, and it was a whirlwind of we won. And there was a lot of excitement, absolutely. Vanquishing Hillary Clinton was absolutely a part of that. And the Republicans, I think, hadn't counted on winning in the same way that the Democrats had so counted on winning, that the surprising win of Donald Trump and the fact that we kept the Senate and kept the House was just an exciting time to be at CPAC and be around other Republicans and conservatives.
So overwhelmingly not a male attendance this year. What else did the young women tell you that you spoke with?
Well, it was the most female CPAC I had ever seen. I would say there were more women this year. I don't have the stats on this, but than I had ever seen before. And there was definitely an atmosphere among the young women, like nobody's going to tell us what kind of women we are, what kind of voters we are. We're going to be independent and decide for ourselves. And it was really nice to see. I think that in so many ways, there's a lot of stuff going on in conservatism and in the Republican Party for women that's really not getting a lot of attention on the national stage. I think it's the golden age of conservative female writing right now, and I think that's being sort of not even mentioned nationally or in any way that it would be mentioned in a much bigger way if it was liberal writing that was all of a sudden having these amazing female writers out right now. So I think when you look at conservatism or the Republican Party, there's always going to be this idea from the left that they're not for women. But if this election showed anything, it's that white women went for Donald Trump, and it's really the Democrats that need to make up ground with them.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. I'm speaking with Carol Markowitz, columnist for the New York Post. I wanted to bring into the conversation now two Connecticut women in studio with me. First, Liz Karantowicz, political consultant, former chief of staff and finance director for the Connecticut Republican Party. Welcome to the show, Liz.
Thanks for having me.
Also, Representative Gebran, Melissa Gebran, state representative for the 34th District. That's East Hampton, East Haddam, and Colchester. Representative Gebran, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning. It's nice to be here.
So listening to our earlier guest and Carol, as two women who are registered Republicans, tell us what your observations are post-election of how people view women who are in the Republican Party. I'll start with you, Liz.
You know, I don't know that I've seen a huge change in the way people see Republican women. I think, you know, nationally, when you look at the party and where we're going, you know, I think we've got, look, we had 690 women running for state office in 2015, 2016, compared to 550 women running in the previous cycle. You know, in Connecticut, our House Republican caucus has 22 female members. The House Democrats only have 21. We've got two Republican women sitting in the state Senate. The Democrats, they've got an advantage there of five. But, you know, when I look at Republican women and where this party is going and how we, you know, continue to grow, I look at the leaders we have in our party and the people who represent us, like Representative Gibran, and how they are speaking for the party and the things that we believe.
So, Representative Gibran, Liz had mentioned that in Connecticut, the landscape, there are a lot of women in the Republican Party that are in leadership roles. But what about nationally? You know, what's your take of what the national GOP is doing and in terms of working with women leaders to work them through the party?
Well, I have to be honest with you. I don't spend a lot of time thinking about the national landscape when we're facing over a $3 billion budget deficit in the state of Connecticut. As the ranking member of the Appropriations Committee, I've been spending most of my time working with women, Republicans, and leaders, not just in the Capitol, but, you know, there's hundreds of them on boards of education, town councils, and others that are very concerned about whether they're going to be able to have a budget in place in time for this coming spring. And so that's been my focus. Certainly many members of my family are more focused on the national level of politics, but I continue to focus on Connecticut.
Of the women constituents that you talk to, are any of them focusing on the national level?
Or you know, there are some. You know, I think that there's, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine, a very active Democrat, and the loss that they felt assuming that Hillary Clinton was going to be their president was very visceral. And when I had the opportunity to talk to them and could see the emotion behind it, while I disagreed certainly with many of her policies, especially the fact that she actually stated that her number one enemy, Hillary Clinton's number one enemy, wasn't ISIS, wasn't poverty, it was Republicans, made me very concerned. But I could understand my Democrat friends who really believed and invested in her candidacy. They did feel devastated. And I think that there's been a lot of reflection for them and for their party on a number of fronts. But again, while I certainly listen to my family's banter, I keep reminding them that we have a $3.5 billion budget deficit, and I wish they would get as more concerned about their Connecticut dream and their ability to live here than the Republican national scene.
Certainly the budget deficit, yet another year, is important. But from what you were saying, it speaks to the divisions that people feel within their communities when they're frustrated with the political process, whether locally or nationally.
Yeah.
How do we correct that? How do we work on that?
Well, that's a great question and something I really actually have pride myself on. And it's really about trying not to take it personally and talking about policy, not being afraid to talk to those who disagree with you. And I think that's one of my frustrations with some of my more liberal friends, is that we can't seem to talk about policy without them immediately bringing up Donald Trump and whatever he might have said this week or last week. And immediately, because I might agree with one of his policies, you know, immediately you're labeled as well. So how do we get across away from this division really is by keeping the communication open, not shutting people down, not calling people a racist because they might have one opinion that aligns with Donald Trump and not another. You know, I am a more socially liberal Republican. I've never felt shut down in the Republican Party when I share my views, but I know my conservative Democrat friends who may be pro-life or may be more conservative bent don't feel like they can contribute with their Democrat colleagues. So I just continue to try talking to people. I have a very good relationship with my Democrat colleagues in the House and the Senate. And, you know, sometimes we get fiery in a meeting, but I try to the next day, you know, break bread over a cup of coffee and say, all right, let's get back to work. And I think that's what we need to do.
Liz, did you want to add to that the idea of I'm assuming that both of you, from the notes that I'm reading, there's certain views that you have from that, even though you're registered Republicans,
sure,
are more socially liberal. And so is that something that, you know, is more like a New England Republican versus when you're looking at another state, another member?
It's funny when you when I talk with colleagues, you know, at the national level, you know, our politics are different up here than they are in a lot of places. But, you know, one of the things we were talking about earlier is, I think sometimes having different views within the bigger tent of the Republican Party allows you to be an advocate for those things and have conversations, because on agreement, you know, you believe in self-governance. You believe in growing the economy from the bottom up instead of top down. You don't think that a one-size-fits-all government approach is the way to go. And so when you have common ground on those things and you can have a conversation with colleagues within the party, you know, you talk to them about some issues that maybe you don't agree on, it gives you a position of strength. And there's an open dialogue, like Melissa is saying, about, you know, how do you have those conversations? I think one of the mistakes that Democrats are going to make in response to this election is if they think identity politics are going to continue winning them elections, they're wrong. And I think that's one thing that the lesson, the takeaway I see from the presidential election is identity politics are not going to win elections. And, you know, President Obama did not win on identity politics. He won on a promise for hope and change. You know, and I think this need to identify and define everybody within their little segment of the population, I think that's wrong. And I think that delivered the presidency to Donald Trump.
I think you're right in many ways, Liz. Absolutely. You know, people are quick to try to typecast a Republican woman, and they do so at their own peril. The idea that I'm making decisions at the Capitol based on my uterus and not based on my ability to afford where I'm living, making sure my children aren't saddled with debt and that they can afford to live in Connecticut, is a mistake. I think with my pocketbook just like men do, and certainly I have issues on social things, and I fight for them. Tomorrow I'm going to be supporting a bill for conversion therapy. I mean, the idea that Republican women don't actually have an opinion on other issues that affect their pocketbook and their ability to live is a mistake. We think that way first. The economy is first. All the other things we think about as well, but the economy is always first.
I wanted to get our previous guest, Carol Markowitz, back into the discussion again, columnist for the New York Post. You know, I wanted to ask you the original question I had also about leadership within the Republican Party, where we're not just seeing men, predominantly white men, speaking out. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on efforts within the National Republican Party to have more women leaders up front.
Yeah, I think that there absolutely is that effort, and there have been so many great female candidates elected recently. You know, the youngest woman ever elected to Congress, Elise Stefanik, is a Republican. You know, Mia Love. There's been a lot of really dynamic women being elected. Obviously, there's still a long way to go. But, you know, I think that the other two guests made some really great points, which are that when women are treated like they are some marginal group, I think that's a real issue. And I think that's what Democrats are doing right now. They treat like women as if they're some tiny slice of the population, and they're just not. And they have a lot of the same concerns that men do and a lot of the same worries and priorities. And I think the Republican Party really is speaking to those priorities. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens in a post-Trump Republican Party when it isn't quite as, you know, Trump was the cudgel to beat Republican women with, like, how can you vote for this man? He makes really terrible comments about women. But in a post-Trump Republican Party, what's going to be the argument from the left for why women shouldn't be voting Republican? It's going to be really interesting to see.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're talking about the role of women in the Republican Party, the issues that matter to them. Roy's calling from Hartford. Roy, you're on the show.
Great. Thank you, Lucy. Love your show.
Thank you.
Yeah, my question and my comments are for Ms. Markowitz. Like, how can she, as a woman, represent this man in the White House and his cabinet? I think of it as more of like an insult to my daughter, my sister, my wife, and my mother. And how does she explain this in her own household if she has daughters and so forth?
All right, Roy, thank you for your question. Carol, you've probably heard that one before.
Yes, once or twice. Well, so first of all, I didn't support Donald Trump. I didn't support him in the primary. I didn't support him in the general election. I kind of sat this election out. But again, it had nothing to do with as a woman. It wasn't me as a woman voting against Trump or not supporting Trump. I went third party. I think that the idea that I should be doing anything as a woman is just, again, I find that really offensive, because you're saying yourself, as a man, you didn't support Donald Trump. So why should I be doing anything specific as a woman? You know, just to flip that around a little bit, I didn't vote for Hillary Clinton either. And, you know, despite the fact that she and I are both women, I don't see eye to eye with her on anything. So it turns out women aren't this monolithic group that all should think the same way. And I have a lot of women friends who did support Donald Trump and who are hoping for the best with his administration. And some of them voted for Obama the last time. So, again, women are complex voters, and just like men are, and they have a lot of different priorities. And to pigeonhole them as just having, you know, one priority or to be voting only as a woman or not like as you know, a businesswoman or as in any of the other issues that men would vote on is just, you know, a little bit unfair and just wrong, really. It's women aren't going to be voting like that anymore.
I think it also says something, Carol, that you said that you sat out of this election. You know, the parties need to do a better job of finding candidates and nominating candidates that speak to people. The moderates in the party seem to always be the ones ignored.
Well, I would that might be true. I am a conservative. I'm not a moderate. I don't. I have, you know, my conservative things that I believe from a conservative perspective. And so for me, it really was Donald Trump was just not a conservative enough. He wasn't talking about issues that matter to me, like free trade or just smaller government. All I kept hearing from him was, you know, the same language of liberals of we're going to take care of everyone. And when I hear that, I just hear government involvement in every area of our lives and higher, you know, just more funding from the government for everything. And that was really concerning to me. And among other things, obviously, with him. But, you know, I think that the parties have to represent who their voters are. And I have to admit, the Republican Party has a gigantic tent at this point. And Donald Trump really did speak to people in a way that previous Republican candidates hadn't, because they didn't go on to win the elections. So no matter what I think personally about Donald Trump, I have to respect the fact that he hit on something in people and they really responded to him.
Before we go, I wanted to talk about your most recent article in the New York Post, telling both the Democrats and Republicans to get over Hillary Clinton. Why is she still such a central figure?
Well, that's the thing. We've spent 20 plus years wondering what is Hillary Clinton going to do next? And wondering that, it's hard to stop asking. So that's why we keep asking, is she going to run for mayor of New York? Is Chelsea going to be a U.S. senator? It's just we're so wrapped up in the Clintons for so long, and both parties really need to let go of her. And, you know, I got a lot of, in the last 12 hours since the article went up, I've gotten a lot of pushback from liberals and Democrats saying, no, I'm still with her. I want her in 2020. And that's exactly what I'm saying. Like, you have to let go of Hillary Clinton. There has to be other candidates. It can't just be Hillary Clinton every time. And
how sad for Democrats they have that they're pinning their hopes on her. We've got a plethora of Republican women that could step in. I mean, you mentioned it before, Susana Martinez, Nikki Haley. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've got tremendous women that can come up the ranks here. Look, 690 women ran for legislative office in the last cycle.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah, and on the Democrat side, Hillary is all the air in the room, and that's
how
really
sad.
A problem.
Sad.
You know? But you also mentioned in your article that the extreme right also needs to get over Hillary.
Absolutely. I think that
we wish we could, but she's constantly in the news.
let's talk more about Bernie. All right. Well, I want to go ahead, Carol, before we head to break.
Yeah, I was going to say just that, you know, absolutely the right needs to move on from her. There was so much at CPAC, still mention of CPAC and of Hillary, and she needs to just fade out, and just like other losing candidates have, and she needs to just kind of leave us alone for a minute to like recuperate from the Hillary Clinton years.
Well, Carol Markowitz is a columnist for the New York Post. Thank you for joining us today, Carol.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, we'll continue our conversation about women in the Republican Party. Two of them are in studio with me, and we'll shift from the national scene to what's happening locally. Are you a woman who's part of the Republican Party in Connecticut? Join the conversation. Email where we live at WMPR.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're talking about Republican women in leadership roles, especially in Connecticut, including Representative Themis Claridis and New Britain Mayor Aaron Stewart. We're talking about women in the GOP today. In studio with me is Liz Karantowicz, political consultant, former chief of staff and finance director for the Connecticut Republican Party, and State Representative Melissa Gebran, state representative of the 34th District, East Hampton, East Haddam, and Colchester. I wanted to take a quick call. Betty's calling from Voluntown. Betty, you're on the show.
Thanks for taking my call. So just want to give a heads up. I was a Republican until the recent election between Blumenthal and McMahon. I grew up in the second wave of feminism and a very strong feminist, but was true to my Republican roots until we had the last Republican candidate for Senate, because I think it became a values issue for me. It seems like the Republican Party became an issue of values, and to have someone come into office who really through her work, segregated women was the final straw for me, and that's when I decided to leave the Republican Party.
All right. Thank you, Betty, for your comment. Liz, did you want to respond?
No, she's entitled to her opinion. I disagree with the view, but that's okay.
It's so often when we do think about what makes people vote for someone in political office, it's hard for people to separate, say, what they may believe in terms of a political party's agenda and what their personal beliefs are, or what they do in, their employment. Representative Gebran, did you want to respond at all to, you know, how people, I guess, rate candidates when they're thinking about, you know, electing them?
No, I think she's perfectly, she should be able to make those decisions. Again, that's, you know, the mistake I think people make by painting Republicans with one, you know, wide brush. I think that it's important that people feel like if they're not being heard, no matter which political party that they're belonging to or participating in, that they can make a choice.
You mentioned not generalizing. So when we talk about the issues within Connecticut that women leaders in the Republican Party are bringing up, talk again about some of the things that you want to be speaking about and getting attention about in terms of how you're addressing concerns from constituents.
Well, I think there's a wide variety of bills that you're looking at in this session. Right now is kind of the frenzy of the public hearing process. And so this morning on my Facebook page, which people can find at hashtag CTHouse34, I posted the whole agenda for this week. And there's a lot of bills that I have co-sponsored and some I haven't that are probably more controversial than others. I mentioned earlier, and I appreciate the correction, I was supporting a bill to stop conversion therapy, to ban conversion therapy. And my friend, Representative Curry, has proposed that, and I'm one of the co-sponsors. And then probably one of the most controversial bills that I've been working on is a bill to legalize recreational adult use of marijuana. Those will be heard this week. There's another thing that I think people need to think about, too, and that's the outrageous gun permit fees. Those will be heard in the Finance Revenue Bond Commission. There's a lot of different things going on this week, and I think that's why when people want me to talk about the federal scene, it's difficult for me to do that because I'm so focused on what's going on locally.
So the economy, number one concern that you're hearing from your constituents.
Yeah, well, the governor's budget is built on a lot of premises. One is that he's going to find $700 million in the first year and $846 million in the second year for union concessions. I know that that's going on now. In fact, we had a meeting with Republicans, believe it or not, aghast behind closed doors with the AFL-CIO. Lori Pelletier was gracious enough to come in and give an overview of the collective bargaining process, and I wanted to make sure that the appropriation Republican members had that opportunity. So, you know, that's one. Changing teacher pensions and putting that on municipalities, over $400 million, and then a number of other things. But most important to my constituents is education funding, shifting literally 130 towns' tax dollars to direct it to 30 communities, which would leave gaping holes in many budgets across the state. In my district alone, East Hampton stands to lose over $3 million. Colchester is a little bit more than that. East Haddam is close to $2 million. But there's some communities in the Greenwich-Fairfield area that may have zero funding for their kids. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of work to do, and the budget process is just ramping up now.
I wanted to talk more about young Republicans. You know, we heard about a lot of people at CPAC this year, different attendees from previous years. Liz Karantowicz, can we talk a little bit about from some of the grassroots of work that you've done? You know, what do you see are some of the issues that young Republicans are, you know, focusing on?
Yeah, I mean, I think that young Republicans here and everywhere, they're, you know, we're talking about the most empowered next generation of voters, right? You know, millennials, next generation voters, however you want to classify them. They're the most empowered generation this country has ever seen. They have the world literally at their fingertips. And when we talk to them about issues that are core Republican values, things like self-government, self-determination, an open government versus a closed government, building our economy from the bottom up rather than top down, empowering communities and people to make decisions as opposed to empowering government to make those decisions for you. You know, we win. And I think, you know, particularly in the last 8 years or so, you know, as we're experiencing some down times in the country economically, and certainly here in Connecticut, the Democrats' response has been, well, we'll manage your decline, right? And I think Republicans are in a position now, as Melissa is showing, to offer a different way and to say, well, we don't have to manage your decline. We can help you do better, and we can empower you to make decisions about your future that are going to allow you to live in Connecticut, to grow a family in Connecticut, to build a business in Connecticut. And that's why Republicans are winning at the local and legislative level. I mean, you know, 30% of the House Republican caucus is women compared to 26% of the House Democrat caucus. So clearly women leaders are alive and thriving in Connecticut politics, and we're all better for it. Because as Melissa said, you know, it's about working across the aisle, working within your caucus with people who disagree with you.
Yeah.
And I think that lively discussion exists much more so in Republican circles, I think, probably than it does on Democrat circles. So,
absolutely.
You know, I think we're in a great position. You know, and look, the Republican Party, Republican candidates are going to last a lot longer than one presidency, no matter how long it lasts for. So I think the future is bright for us.
You say Republicans are at the table. We've only got 30 seconds, but we shouldn't remind people that the Senate, there is now a tie within
That's
the
right.
Republican and Democrats. You finally feel like you're at the table to talk further negotiations with how to get Connecticut out of this next budget deficit.
And the House is only four votes shy
That's
of
right.
a majority. So, you know, I mean, things are changing in this state.
Well, I want to thank Liz Karantowicz, political consultant, former chief of staff and finance director for the Connecticut Republican Party. Nice to have you on the show today.
Thanks
Liz.
So much for having me.
Also, Representative Melissa Gebren, state representative for the 34th District, East Hampton, East Haddam, and Colchester. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
Our show is produced by Lydia Brown and Jeff Tyson. And special thanks to WNPR executive producer Katie Tolarski for today's show. Our technical producer is Kion Wolf. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil, and thanks for listening.